What in the world is happening on Wall Street?
Two-year note yields went from 190 to 166 in the blink of an eye.
I have never live looked at the Dow Jones Industrial Board and seen a 600-point loss.
The Dow traders are standing there watching in amazement, and I don't blame them.
In 2008, financial markets around the world fell into chaos, making the limitations of our current neoliberal financial system starkly apparent. Now, about a decade later, we're likely headed the same way again. It's never been more pressing to imagine and build a political economy that radically reshapes our financial, fiscal, and monetary systems. We need a systemic reversal to ensure that public resources serve people and planet and enhance collective and individual well-being. Hello and welcome. My name is Sean Marchesa, and you're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. TNI is an international research and advocacy institute committed to building a just, democratic, and sustainable planet. For more than four decades, we've worked with social movements around the world to challenge the powerful. In each episode, we share our research and explore alternatives to the status quo. We highlight some of the scholars and activists who are in the forefront of the fight against the broader neoliberal order. This particular installment of the podcast is drawn from discussions around an upcoming TNI publication on how we can build public finance for the future we want. TNI brought together experts to consider a counter perspective, to look at existing options, and to develop radical but viable proposals and practices so that we are ready when the next financial crisis comes around. As much as possible, we aim to show real-world examples of how progressive authorities, social movements, workers, and unions can lead the way towards democratic and diverse ownership of finances and wealth that cater more to the public interest than to private interests. Today, I try to understand the role that public banks can play in building alternative finance. We take a look at the ongoing case of a public bank in Belgium that's facing reprivatization. And stick around if you want to find out more about the role that art and culture can play in making finance penetrable, accessible to people outside of these industries.
My name is Thomas Marwa, and I'm a senior lecturer in development studies at SOAS University of London.
Thomas' chapter is about public banks and the role that they may potentially play in financing a just and sustainable green transition to a low-carbon, climate-resilient future. I began by asking him what he means by this transition.
The big issue right now that is central to the Sustainable Development Goals Agenda, the 2030 Agenda, is that infrastructure is key to reducing carbon emissions. That 60% of global greenhouse gas emissions come from infrastructure. So the push is to think about creating low carbon instead of high carbon infrastructure. Mm-hmm. But this costs money.
Yeah.
And so the question of the transition to a low carbon future immediately raises the question, where is the money going to come from, the financing of it?
Mm-hmm. So what's your take on this? Where is the money going to come from?
What the dominant narrative in the international development community is right now is that the public sector has a role to support private finance, who has excess financial capacity, have lots of money, but has been unwilling to finance this transition because it's a bit too risky, it's a bit too long-term, and that private finance doesn't see that they will get enough returns out of it. So they don't like the risk-return profile. Uh-huh. So the solution is to take public banks to support private finance.
So to support private finance, how? This is to underwrite the...
To absorb some of the risk uh-huh. of investment. So if you're going to build a great big low-carbon hydro dam or some sort of solar transition to solar energy, it's going to cost money. And what they want is that the public banks either co-invest mm-hmm. or create some what they call blending mechanism where you take some public money grants or public loan and mix with private that essentially guarantees that there's no risk of them losing that investment. The problem with that is that the risk falls on the public sector. It also means right from the very beginning that these plans, this transition to a low-carbon future, the building of the infrastructure, and the logic of it, it's so about ensuring the needs of the private investor in terms of its risk-return profile of maximizing profit. Uh-huh. And so the public sector is supporting that.
Right. How do we do it any different? Isn't the argument that, well, there's no capacity to do it on our own, we need to have the private sector on board in order to achieve what we need to achieve? What's the alternative?
Part of the alternative is seeing the reality of the situation. The way it's being framed, the narrative within financing the SDGs, is that the public sector doesn't have the capacity to lead on these projects of financing new infrastructure. And to back that up, they say, well, you know, we only have a few public development banks. They don't have a lot of resources. We have a few of these multilateral development banks like the World Bank or like the African Development Bank. And they don't have a lot of resources either. We just don't have the capacity. Maybe if you add everything up, there might be $2 or $3 or maybe $5 trillion worth of assets in the public banks. And that maybe there are at most a couple hundred public banks around there. And so what I do in this chapter is I say, well, actually, we need to crack this narrative.
Right.
That if you're looking at public banks as dominant, I mean, it's hard to define in a sense, but you can do it empirically. You say public banks that are over 50% owned by a public entity or a government that have a public mandate.
So that's how we're defining a public bank broadly.
So we, you know, to get some sense of the numbers, because you have to rely on online databases for this. So it's actually, there are more than 690 public or state-owned banks still in existence around the world. They have assets nearing $40 trillion. So the international development community will often say they have $2 trillion. Wow. Sometimes in some of the documents, you'll hear $5 trillion.
That's it's a fraction. How many orders of magnitude?
It's about 10% of what actually exists. So, and that's at a conservative measure.
Yeah.
If you add in the multilateral development banks, and if you add in things like central banks and public pension funds and public sovereign wealth funds, then the assets can nearly double.
So there's quite a lot of money
under public bank ownership. So just put that in context. At the most conservative, that comes to about $30 trillion. That that is equal to 48% of global GDP in 2017. And that's about the amount of assets that these public banks have control over.
Wow.
So it's massive.
That's a lot. That's a lot of money.
And public banks tend, not always, but they tend to be more conservative. So a public bank will often lend, for every $1 they have in capital, they might lend out 2.5 or 3.
Private banks
are lending,
they go crazy.
Like, I mean, in developing countries, usually about, they'll lend out for every $1 they have, maybe 8, so double or triple. In the U.S., they'll lend out, for every $1 they have, they'll lend out 30 or 40. So there is scope to expand that. And just the simple point being is that the narrative driven by the international development community and private bankers is that public banks should just be in a supportive position. If we want to look at it differently, they actually have the financial capacity to drive the agenda.
To be at the front.
To be at the forefront of financing sustainable development, but in the public interest and along lines that public sector, community, social movements can define through a public banking institution that is simply not available if you go through the private sector.
So what would this look like, this public interest-driven public bank?
So in the chapter, I give an example, and it talks about this one public bank. It's a multinational public bank, the Nordic Investment Bank, that is owned by the Nordic countries, Scandinavian countries and the Baltic countries. But basically, it has a mandate to fund projects within these communities that lead to some form of economic development or economic sustainability and help grow the communities economically. But those same investments should also be environmentally sustainable. So they have this dual mandate of helping develop economically, but in a way that is sustainable.
So that's literally sustainable development.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And so, I mean, they do lots of different projects, but this one stood out to me where in the north of Norway, I believe it was six municipalities decided to band together to invest in hydroelectric dams. And they're building them with a view to sustainability.
Thomas is referring to a project by Helgoland Kraft AS, a public hydropower company owned by 14 municipalities in the Nordland County of Norway. They partnered with the Nordic Investment Bank to get the money.
And the interesting part of it is that, so you've got a public bank that's supporting communities that have identified a need for energy and electricity.
Right.
But on top of this, they wanted to create these hydroelectric dams so that they would inspire the future. So they're architectural wonders. They're beautiful. They're beautifully designed. They fit into the sort of wilderness, if you will, the natural sort of rugged background. You can see some pictures of them if you look online. Built in a way that it would encourage people who live in the community from abroad to go hiking and to look at these buildings and to see them in the way in which they're designed to inspire them to protect the environment. Working together an idea of future sustainability, but also linking it to a cultural sense of the need to instill in your society a love of nature and a sense of future responsibility. And it can occur through finance. And that's, we always think it's so separate from us.
Yeah.
It's not. Public can partner with other public organizations and do something not only that is viable economically and financially, but something that's socially beautiful and sustainable. Do it much better in a way than you could if it was just about profit maximization, making the ugliest dam possible in the fastest way.
The most efficient, cost-efficient way.
Yeah, yeah.
I had one last question. Does the fact that a bank is public automatically mean that it will work in the public interest? Thomas doesn't think so.
Simply because a bank or anything is publicly owned doesn't mean it's going to work in the public interest or in the common good by any means. The banks in this world that exist today that do engage in things like funding a community-driven project for sustainable energy or do other projects that support the community do so because the community forces them to, because there is a historical or cultural or social content to that public bank that makes it work in the public interest. There are plenty of public banks in this world that don't, because there's no mechanism or no way by which society at this given time is able to influence it for different political reasons, because of neoliberalism. 40 years of neoliberalism has, you know, said that public banks shouldn't care about democracy. They should be separate. There should be no influence from the public. That's terrible for them. And it's a big barrier.
Yeah.
So the point being is that what a public bank is and what it does depends on what the public demands of it. And societies have to demand that of the banks that they have, of these massive amount of resources, $38 trillion in assets.
So there's still need for a political agenda.
Still need for a political agenda, for mobilization, agenda. For activism around it. And, you know, and just imagining the realm of the possible of these institutions we have.
So, what lies in the realm of the possible? Some activists in Belgium are showing just what citizens can do to reclaim financial power. They are involved in a long struggle to stop the privatization of a public bank, Belfius Bank and Insurance. They aim to put it under democratic control and to keep the public interest as its primary mandate. I spoke to one of them.
My name is Frank van Aerschot. I live in Belgium, in Brussels. I work for an NGO called Fairfin. We do many activities relating to finance and how it impacts society. We have one project on a bank which has been nationalized after the financial crisis. It's called Belfius. And the government has nationalized it reluctantly. They didn't want to do it, but it was the only way to make sure that everything didn't collapse.
Uh-huh.
And they've kept it for a number of years to wait that it became more stable again.
Yeah.
And once it became more stable, they said, okay, now let's reprivatize.
Okay, so I need to hear this story in detail. This bank was owned by the government?
So, historically,
yeah,
it's in the middle of the 19th century, actually.
Yeah.
The government back then, they decided, okay, let's create a public bank for the local governments because some of them, they have difficulties to finance themselves. So we have this bank and their role is to give credits to especially the smaller local governments at affordable rates.
Mm-hmm.
And when you took a loan as a local government, you also had to become a shareholder of the bank, which made that actually it's the local governments who own their own bank.
Uh-huh.
And this bank, like, they played, for example, an important role in the First World War, after the First World War in the Reconstruction. Mm-hmm. And after the Second World War, they opened up to the public, which means that citizens, they could take an account in the bank. Mm-hmm. And it worked well for 150 years, actually.
So it used to be local governments that had accounts and hence owned a little bit of the bank. And then it opened up to citizens to have an account, mm-hmm, and also become partial owners.
No. They didn't become owners. They could become clients. Before it was a bank that purely was there to finance the local governments and give services to the local governments. And then it started also to give services to the public,
yeah,
to private clients. But they didn't become shareholders of the bank.
Okay, and then what happened next?
Well, in the 90s, as part of a bigger wave of privatization in the financial sector, both in Belgium and Europe, and I think elsewhere as well, and you had this big privatization wave, and in 2000, they went to the stock exchange. Then it was really privatized banks, and they also went to the US, and they really grew spectacularly.
Yeah.
And they started to do a lot of the financial speculation business that was central to the problem of the financial crisis.
That's basically what everyone was doing at the
time.
Yeah,
exactly. And they did it in a very, very reckless way. And their survival was dependent on the...
Basically the mood of the market.
On the mood of the market, on the willingness of all these external investors to lend them billions and billions and billions of euros and dollars on a daily basis. This proved lethal for this bank. And then the only thing that could happen was that the government bailed out the bank.
Uh-huh. So the government basically replenished the money that the bank was supposed to have.
Exactly.
To keep the ship going.
Yeah. And this happened once in 2008.
Uh-huh.
But 3 years later,
mm-hmm,
the bank collapsed again.
Again?
Yes. It was one of the banks that had two bailouts.
Wow.
They collapsed two times.
So if the government bailed them out, not only once, but twice, then the government re-owned the bank.
The government, they nationalized this reluctantly.
Yeah.
They didn't want to do this.
Uh-huh.
They did it because it was the only thing that was possible.
Yeah.
That time,
yeah,
there was not a single private investor that wanted to put 1 euro cent in this bank.
Yeah.
And there were all these crucial activities, such as financing the local governments, et cetera, mm-hmm, as I said. So they nationalized it. The idea being that, okay, we keep it for a couple of years until the whole situation stabilizes again, and then we reprivatize.
Mm-hmm.
And in the meantime, we, which is like Fairfin, but also like many other, like in total, we created a platform with 30 other organizations.
Mm-hmm.
We created a platform which said Belfius is ours.
Mm-hmm.
Said we paid for it. Historically, this is a public bank which finances our local governments.
Mm-hmm.
It had a brief stint of 15 years of privatization, and it completely fucked
up.
Yeah. And then it had to be nationalized again. And now the government wants to reprivatize. No.
Mm-hmm.
No. We want to keep this bank public, and we want to make sure that it serves the needs of society. So we want more democratic control in this bank.
Uh-huh.
So we created this platform with the name Belfius is Ours to defend keeping the bank public and to democratize it.
Yeah.
And created a manifesto with 3 points, which are really important. And any organization that wanted to support us
had to agree to these three points.
And we say one thing, the bank needs to be led by a public mission.
Uh-huh.
The priority of the bank has to be the mission. What is its role in society? Who does it have to serve?
Uh-huh. So maintaining the public interest is the, yes, the main...
Exactly. This has to be the priority of the bank.
The reason for the bank.
And then the second point is, we need the kind of ownership that allows the mission to be the priority of the bank.
Right.
And that's why we said we don't want to privatize partially even, because the proposal of the government was to partially privatize the bank.
Uh-huh.
But we said, no, we don't want to have 60% public control. We want to have 100% public control.
It's our
bank. Because it's our bank. And like, let's say we privatize the bank 40%.
Yeah.
These 40%, these investors, these private investors...
Yeah.
How are you going to make your bank attractive for these private investors? You have to become very profitable.
Yeah.
And if the bank has to be as profitable as these private investors want them to be, then our mission cannot be the priority anymore.
Yeah.
So we don't want a partial privatization. Yeah,
no half cancer.
Exactly.
Half cancer is still cancer.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And then we said, but it's not because the state... owns the bank, that we have a guarantee that it will be well run. There also needs to be some kind of democratic control. There needs to be mechanisms in place with which other stakeholders, such as the clients of the bank, the staff of the bank, other parts of civil society who work on environmental issues, social issues, etc.
So they can participate
in the decision-making. Yes, that they can have a role in the definition of the mission of the bank. And afterwards, can also do oversight to make sure that the bank is respecting the mission.
Uh-huh. What is the core of what the chapter is about in the book?
The core of the chapter, it's really about how can we make the best of the opportunity that the crisis has given us.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That's actually what it's about.
That's what it's about.
Because, you know, like, the crisis has thrown this institution back into our hands, and it's about redefining and recreating what it originally was about 2 centuries later.
The case of Belfius in Belgium is only one example of citizens taking an active role in trying to define how public finances are used. But there's no denying that issues of finance are not easily understood, and this raises the threshold of meaningful participation. I have to admit that I myself sometimes find myself lost in the labyrinth of abstract financial terms as I research this podcast. This can easily lead to a sense of powerlessness.
One of the things that we notice is that the banking crisis does to people is that it creates hopelessness.
Yeah.
They're frustrated. Everybody's angry at banks. Very easy to find people who are angry at banks.
Yeah.
But not so many people want to appropriate them.
Mm-hmm.
While...
to show how to do things differently.
Yeah. Well, this is what we should do. Like, if we have to pay for... if these banks are too big to fail, if we have to pay for them, then they should be ours.
Yeah. And they're powerful institutions that can actually...
And this is the thing, like, we are educated not to think about finance, to leave this to experts. Well, it's the financial expert itself who failed spectacularly during the crisis because they didn't see it coming and they didn't prevent it at all. So the society definitely has a legitimate role to appropriate and to talk about finance and to have control over banks. I think then this is the most important part, is to show to citizens and to people who are mobilized on social issues and on environmental issues that finance plays a super important role in what they are doing. And that if you control the bank, if you control this tool, this economic weapon, which creates money and which creates the possibility of what the future of society and economy will look like, then you really have a lot of power in your hands. And it's there.
You can actually fight back.
It's there, yes, it's there. And then we can define our own future if we control the bank.
One way to get the public to join the fight is to use the arts and culture to lower the threshold and to make the esoteric world of finance accessible to everyone. Who else can better explain the alchemy that bankers get up to than a former banker?
So my name is Aline Fares. I'm French, based in Brussels. I've been working for a while in banking until 2011.
Aline is also a member of Fairfin. And in an attempt to get more people interested in finance and how it translates into power, she's designed a role-playing poker game, as well as using a stand-up show to explain some of the mechanisms behind the banking industry. I asked her to tell me more about her show.
Chronique d'une ex-banquière, so it means chronicles from a former banker. Jusqu'à présent, et surtout depuis quelques années, j'avais ce problème du sentiment de solitude dans les dîners entre amis ou en famille. It's a mix of my own experience as a banker, so I'm making fun of myself so people can make fun of me. Of my experience at FinanceWatch, so I'm telling about the issue with the regulatory process in Europe.
Uh-huh.
And it ends up with my story as an activist.
Mm-hmm.
And all along the way of telling this personal story that helps, you know, create like some engagement with the public that is a bit funny and easy going, you know.
Yeah.
I give some explanation on the way things go. So on what maximization of shareholder value makes to banking activities.
Yeah.
On what blocks the participation of the public in regulatory process in Europe and why we come out with just shitty regulation all the time since 10 years.
Yeah.
And the third part is about, but how can we engage the public? So I'm sharing really my questions and trying to give some insights on how financialization works, what it does to our world, our planet, to life in general.
Yeah.
And it ends up with quite some engaging question for people. Some people are very shocked.
Yeah.
Some are re-energized, but it's never neutral. The result is never neutral. And I think this is what we can do with the discussion on public finance, but all the ideas that we are discussing now on public finance require, however, to tell first, look, this is a topic you can and you have the right and you must engage with because you are legitimate and you are the most legitimate.
In addition to her own story, Aileen also uses the show to help people understand the reasons behind their own feelings of powerlessness and to begin to break down the walls of financial power.
There is one thing that I finished with in the conference in my stand-up show.
Mm-hmm.
And it tells about what prevents us from acting and from engaging on finance and banking.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm saying that there is like walls that surround us and prevent us from moving.
Mm-hmm.
And there would be four walls.
Yeah.
The first one is the symbolic power of finance. Mm-hmm. You know, the big towers, the suits and ties, complex words, all these signs that you have nothing to do there. You know, it's not your business. Don't worry. These big guys will take care of it.
Will take care of it.
So that's the symbolic power. There is another wall, which is the institutional power, meaning all the regulatory framework and processes and the so-called democratic process for bank regulation. But if you look at it more closely, for example, in Europe, at the Commission, at the Parliament, it's so complicated. Everything is posed into technical terms.
Yeah.
Plus, the processes of consultation are not democratic. The whole thing is not made for popular participation.
Yeah.
So here again, we are pushed back from being invited. We're not invited to participate in real.
Yeah.
And there is a third wall that is surrounding us, which is quite complicated because it's how we've are being constantly and increasingly intricated with this whole system because of private pensions. Because to access studies, we need to borrow money from the bank.
Alone. It's almost made impossible to live outside of this finance net, basically, that's been put around us.
Yes, but it's about reclaiming public services for housing, education, retirement, and once you have that, you don't have to enter this whole shit, you know.
Yeah.
And the fourth wall I tell is about the state and law and enforcement of law and the police and the prison and, you know, all these rules that tell you that if you touch this, you will be in trouble,
yeah,
because this is where the big money is. And I end up telling that one of the issues is also that we need to have images of what the world could look like if we get rid of all this big money that is just killing us, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's an invitation to reopen our imagination.
Finally, Aileen told me about a memorable interaction she had during one of her sessions and the insights it gave to her.
This lady, she said, we need safe spaces to talk about banking and finance and to engage in this debate in our own terms.
Mm-hmm. Meaning
the language, meaning what is our entry point to this issue.
Yeah.
And in fact, it's very important, this sentence, because it tells about, first, we want to change the battlefield. Our battlefield shall not be the one that is mastered by the bankers and the financiers.
The one they define themselves.
Because they define it themselves.
Yeah.
Because they know the terms, because they master it, because they change it every time. So we are always trying to catch up, but we never can catch up. It's not our field.
They
own
it.
So we need to take them to another field, which is ours, which is the field of civil society, which is political, which tells about transition, which tells about energy, which tells about social justice, environmental justice, and so on and so forth. And this is our space. And this is where we can fix the term of the discussion. And this is where a broad range of people can engage and to be able to change it.
You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. Thank you so much for listening this far. Many thanks go to Thomas Marat, Frank Van Nescott, and Aileen Farris for their input. The episode you just listened to is part of a series based on the upcoming TNI publication, Public Finance for the Future We Want, curated and edited by Satoko Kishimoto and Lavinia Steinfurt. The other episodes focus on how cooperative finance can help to build and distribute our common wealth to serve people and planet, and on how government budgeting can be a tool to finance the public interest. TNI's material is all free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do. If you'd like to find out more about TNI's work and to support us, please look us up at www.tni.org. And find us on social media at TN Institute on Twitter and Transnational Institute on Instagram and Facebook. My name is Sean Macheza. See you next time.